Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Kings chapter 7, verses 13 through 51. In this section, the scripture describes the temple furnishings that Solomon made to provide for his magnificent temple. Our context is this. In the first part of 1 Kings, verses 1 through 12, Solomon has taken time off from building the temple, and he's built his personal palace. The previous chapter, 1 Kings chapter 6, Solomon has built the temple itself, the framework. Now we're going to talk about the furnishings of the temple. Now this is going to be difficult, so what I'm going to do is try to take it one verse at a time and then compare what I read with a picture that I found that pretty well describes the various pieces of furniture, pictures that I found. We have to realize that translation difficulties and interpretation difficulties give room for a lot of disagreement in discussing the question of how these furnishings actually looked. So I'll do the best I can. We start in verse 13, 1 Kings 7. Now King Solomon sent and brought Hiram from Tyre. When you hear that name Hiram and you think the king of Tyre, well, no, this is not the king of Hiram. This is a craftsman who came from Tyre. He happened to have the same name as the king. Verse 14 says he was a widow's son from the tribe of Naphtali. And his father was a man of Tyre, a worker in bronze. And he was filled with wisdom and understanding and skill for doing any work in bronze. And we're going to see there's a whole ton of bronze, so much that it could not be weighed. Whole lot of bronze work being done for this temple. So Hiram is mentioned by name. He's given honor for doing that bronze work. One minor harmonization point here in verse 14, he said he's a widow's son from the tribe of Naphtali. His father was from Tyre, so we read in Chronicles that his mother is from the daughters of Dan. Verse 14, and here in 1 Kings 7, says he was a widow's son. His mother was from the tribe of Naphtali. So in Kings, his mother is from Naphtali, and in Chronicles, his mother is from Dan, and Dan is a different tribe, so how do you reconcile? Well, the easiest way to reconcile that is, in Kings, she's from the tribe of Naphtali, and in Chronicles, she's from the city of Dan, because Dan was a city as well as a tribe. And Dan, of course, was in the tribe of Naphtali. That reconciles it quite easily. Another more forced way you could reconcile it, you could say that the widow, the mother of Hiram, her mother was from Dan, so therefore she's a daughter of Dan in Chronicles, but her father was from Naphtali, and that's why Kings calls her from Naphtali. That is absolutely going to do nothing to enhance your sanctification as you progress toward your final glorified state, but I thought I would mention it anyway. So Hiram came to King Solomon and performed all his work. That's verse 14. Now verse 15, he fashioned the two pillars of bronze. Now these two pillars of bronze were famous. They stood at the doorway of the temple. The southernmost pillar was called Boaz, which translated means in him is strength. And the northernmost pillar was called Jachin, or Jachin if you want to anglicize it terribly, which means he shall establish, J-A-C-H-I-N, he shall establish. And of course, those pillar names have symbolic significance. Now in verse 15, we're told that the height of one pillar was 18 cubits. And of course, a cubit is a foot and a half, most probably. So that would make one temple 27 feet high, which is right high. But in order to reconcile with 2 Chronicles, I'm going to use cubits because it's easier to deal with. Chronicles has 35 feet, not 18 feet. 2 Chronicles 3:15. In front of the building, he set two columns 35 cubits high. Well, how do you reconcile 18 and 35? Well, it's quite simple, or it's relatively simple. In 1 Kings 7, 18 cubits is given as the height of one of the pillars, and in 2 Chronicles 3, 35 cubits is given as the height of both of the pillars. We still have a problem because if one pillar is 18 cubits high, as stated in 1 Kings, you double that, you get 36 cubits, not 35. So where's that missing cubit? A couple of ways to reconcile that. Well, you could say that Kings, in the book of Kings, the author is taking the actual height of the cubits, which is 17 and a half cubits each, and he's rounding it off to 18 cubits. I don't like that solution as much as this one. The extra cubit in Kings, The 36th cubit is for the base, or the capital maybe, of each pillar. But that extra cubit in Chronicles was not counted, wasn't accounted for in the book of Chronicles. All right, that's the height. Now let's look at the circumference. A line of 12 cubits measured the circumference of both. 12 cubits is, of course, 18 feet going around. That's pretty much of a circumference. If you do the math, C equals pi, circumference equals pi times diameter, you end up with a diameter of about 3.82 cubits, which is about 5.73 feet. So let's just round it off to 6 feet. That is a pretty good diameter. That's a huge pillar. Now, Adam Clark says, it would be very difficult to procure a founder who could cast such massive pillars, whether solid or hollow. But Hiram is up to the job because he was skillful. Now, in verse 16, we move to the capitals of the two pillars. He also made two capitals of molten bronze to set on the tops of the pillars. The height of the one capital was 5 cubits, and the height of the other capital was 5 cubits. There were nets of network and twisted threads of chain work for the capitals, which were on top of the pillars, 7 for the one capital and 7 for the other capital. So he made the pillars and 2 rows around on the one network to cover the capitals, which were on the top of the pomegranates. And so he did for the other capital. The capitals which were on top of the pillars and the porch were of lily design, 4 cubits. Now, I know that's impossible to follow the written description of the capitals, so I've got pictures here. And, of course, again, these artist representations are subject to different interpretations, but I think this is a good one here. Let's look at the capital. There's a rounded projection, a round node, as one translation has it, at the top of the pillar itself, and there is two rows of pomegranates around the bottom of that node. Now, that node is 5 cubits high. That's the pillar. 4 cubits high on top of the pillar are the lily leaves, which extend 4 cubits higher than the rounded projection. Now, on that rounded node, or rounded bowl, depends on the translation, there is a network of bronze. It doesn't actually say it's bronze. It says a net of network in the NIV, but it's some kind of network. My diagram here calls it a net of checkerwork because the openings are squares, as the lattice work, if you will, of these bronze wires that are wrapped around that rounded projection, that bowl at the top of the pillar. That's the capital. So you have this network of bronze, and then at the top of the rounded projection, you have a chain that runs around the top, and then hanging down from that top chain are other chains for a total of 7 chains. It says in verse 17, there were 7 chains of one capital and 7 for the other capital. Doesn't say what the chains are made out of. I assume it's bronze. Now we have a reconciliation issue here. For 2 Kings chapter 25, verse 17 says this capital on top of the pillar and underneath the lily leaves, that capital, that rounded bulb with the golden chains hanging off of it, wrapped in that network of bronze. That capital is 5 cubits here in chapter 7, 1 Kings chapter 7, but in 2 Kings chapter 25, verse 17, it says 3 cubits. Let me read that. 2 Kings 25, 17, the height of the one pillar was 18 cubits and a bronze capital was on it. The height of the capital was 3 cubits. 3 cubits, not 5 cubits, with a network and pomegranates on the capital all around. We've already talked about the network and the pomegranates, all of bronze. Well, that proves that it's not gold, it's bronze. I was speaking off the top of my head. So the pomegranates and the network and the chains are bronze. But how do we reconcile the 3 cubits high capital in 2 Kings compared to the 5 cubits high capital in 1 Kings? Well, in 2 Kings 25, 17, we can take the 3 cubits to be understood only of the ornamented part of them, the part with the network of bronze and the gold and the bronze chains that are hanging down from that network. That's 3 cubits high, and then the other 2 cubits are the base below and the rim above that holds the capital. Now, the pomegranates, which I just stated were in a 2 circles around the bottom of the rounded projection, the capital. There is also a row of pomegranates around the top of the capital, right, that separates the capital from the lilies on top of the capital. And So my picture actually matches a description of these two rows of pomegranates given by Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Quote, "These rows of pomegranates were designed to form a binding to the ornamental work to keep it from falling asunder, and they were so placed as to be above the chain work," that means above the rounded pillar where the chains were hanging down over the network. So the pomegranates were above the chain work and below the place where the branch work was. That branch work is the network of bronze squares there, the netting that's around the rounded projection of the capital. So the pomegranates are above and below the capital, holding the capital to the pillar and to the lilies above. We go now to 1 Kings chapter 7, verses 20 through 22. There were capitals on the two pillars, even above and close to the rounded projection which was beside the network. That's what I just described in plain English. This is a little bit complicated. And the pomegranates numbered 200 in rows around both capitals. Verse 21, "Thus he, that Solomon, set up the pillars at the porch of the nave." The nave is the holy place where the seven-branch candlesticks, 10 of them, and the 10 tables of showbread are located, and the golden altar of incense at the west end of it. "Thus he set up the pillars at the porch of the nave." Now, some people say that that means the pillars are right up next to the door of the temple, right at the western end of the porch, Solomon's porch, which we talked about a couple of audios ago. Some people say they were freestanding at the entrance to the porch. It doesn't really say whether where the pillars are. It doesn't really matter. "He set up the right pillar and called it Jachin," or Jachin, which means he will establish. In other words, God's establishing this temple. "And he set up the left pillar and named it Boaz." That's no relation at all to Ruth's husband. Has nothing to do with that. Boaz means in him is strength. Now, when it says right and left, the right pillar being Jachin, that's as you face the temple, you got your back to the east, you're facing the west, as you're going into the holy place, the right pillar is Jachin and the left pillar is Boaz. On the top of the pillars was lily design, which we've already talked about, so the work of the pillars was finished. We go now to 1 Kings 7, verses 23 through 26. "Now he made the sea of cast metal, 10 cubits from brim to brim, circular in form, and its height was 5 cubits and 30 cubits in circumference. Under its brim, gourds went around, encircling it 10 to a cubit, completely surrounding the sea. The gourds were in 2 rows, cast with the rest. It stood on 12 oxen, 3 facing north, 3 facing west, 3 facing south, and 3 facing east. And the sea was set on top of them, and all their rear parts turned inward." That means all the cows had their rear ends facing toward the inside, and their faces were facing out toward the viewer. Verse 26, "It was a handbreadth thick, and its brim was made like the brim of a cup as a lily blossom. It could hold 2,000 baths. Now, this is the big bronze sea, as it's called. I think it's the King James, or the bronze laver. The tabernacle was called a laver. This thing was huge here. 10 cubits from brim to brim. That's 15 cubits wide. 15 feet, I should say, in diameter, 10 cubits from brim to brim. Now, this sea was not only for the priest to wash their hands and feet in, but the priest could actually dip into this sea upon occasion to keep themselves clean. Now, the pieces of meat that needed to be cleaned, the sacrifices, they were not cleansed in this big bronze sea. The pieces of meat for offering were cleansed in the 10 basins, or the 10 stands, which were placed 5 on the northern side and 5 on the southern side of the holy place against the courtyard wall. Now, this is to be contrasted with the bronze laver in the tabernacle, the Exodus tabernacle. There, the pieces of meat and the priest both were washed in the bronze laver, but those two functions are separated out here in Solomon's temple. Now, John Gill has an interesting comment about the gourds that are mentioned in verse 24. "Under its brim, gourds went around, circling it. The gourds were in 2 rows, cast with the rest." Well, Gill has the gourds being hooked up with the oxen. The gourds were on the figures of the heads of oxen. The gourds had on them the figures of the heads of oxen. In other words, the oxen were carved in the gourds, and the oxen served as cocks to let the water out. That's an interesting idea about the water cocks. The gourds are said to be cast together with the sea, according to Gill, and altogether there were about 600 of them. Well, I don't know if that's true. I tend to think that the gourds were separate. They're cast bronze with the sea, but they're separate, and there's a ring around under the brim, and then there's a ring around at the bottom too, probably right above the heads of the oxen who are sticking their heads out, three from the north, three from the south, three from the east, and three from the west. Now, verse 23, this sea is said to be 10 cubits from brim to brim. That's the diameter. So if you calculate the circumference using the formula for circumference, circumference equals pi times diameter. Pi is 3.14159. The diameter here is 10, as is stated in verse 23. So 10 times 3.14159 is 31.4159, or let's just say 31.4 cubits for the circumference. However, the circumference is stated in verse 23 to be 30 cubits, not 31.4. Now, here's what John Gill's editor says. He says that skeptics have ridiculed the Bible for saying that the mathematical constant pi is 3 instead of the more precise 3.14159. And here's how the editor explains one way to explain this. The circumference given, which is 30 instead of 31.4, the circumference given may be for the inside circumference, and the diameter may be the diameter including the thickness of the rim. Remember, there's a rim all around the edge of the bowl. This would yield a very accurate mathematical result for the inside circumference of 30 cubits. The outside circumference would be about 31.4 cubits, given a rim thickness of 4 inches or a hand breadth. Agreeing with 1 Kings 7:26, it said the verse 26, it says it was a hand breadth thick, which the editor of Gill says refers to the brim around the top of the sea. And it could be just 30 cubits as opposed to 31.4. Just could be a round number. 30 does sound kind of like a round number. But anyway, it can be reconciled unless you are a skeptic who wants to deny everything, including your own name, including where you live, including whether there's a planet Earth. If you want to deny everything and be a super skeptic, yeah, you can deny the accuracy of the scripture and say there's an error here. I don't. Now, this big sea, it had a brim, as I said. The brim was made like the brim of a cup as a lily blossom. So if you looked at the sea and the brim around it looked like a blossom, a lily blossom that had opened up, it could hold 2,000 baths. Now, that's the NIV translation. Now, that 2,000 baths has caused me a lot of trouble trying to figure out how many gallons that is, because I don't know what a bath is. So let me give you some options of how many gallons this sea held. The Holman Christian Study Bible says it was 11,000 gallons. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown said that the sea held between 16,000 and 20,000 gallons, thus weighing about 100 tons when filled with water. The God's Word translation says it's 18,000 gallons, which puts it right in the middle of Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's estimation. Well, obviously, the translators have an issue here. So I went back and looked a little closer, and I found out that there are different readings for 1 Kings 7:26. Most translations have it as 2,000 baths. The ESV, the Bible in Basic English, the Darby translation, the King James translation, the NASB, the NIV, Young's Little Translation, they all say 2,000. But the note at Holman Christian Study Bible on 2 Chronicles 4:5, the parallel passage, says the Masoretic text reads 3,000 baths in 1 Kings 7:26. Well, if it reads 3,000 baths, why do all the translators have it at 2,000 baths? I don't know. I can't understand that, because if they just took the Masoretic text, made it read 3,000, you go to the 2 Chronicles, which says 3,000, there's your harmony. There's no reconciliation problem at all. But all the translations say 2,000. So that's something that's going to take a PhD in New Testament studies or Old Testament studies to explain that to me one day. But if it is true that the correct reading is 2,000 baths in 1 Kings 7:26 and 3,000 baths in 2 Chronicles 4:5, here's a way you could reconcile it. The 3,000 baths, as in 2 Chronicles 4:5, that is measuring the water when the sea was filled to the brim, whereas the 2,000 baths, as in 1 Kings chapter 7, verse 26, those 2,000 baths were the measurement of the sea when just enough water was put in the sea for the priest to wash in. It wasn't totally filled up. Well, it can be reconciled. I'm not exactly sure how. But whatever it is, how many every gallons it is, 11,000 or 18,000 or 20,000, that's a lot of water. So the next question is how could the sea hold so much water? John Gill says, well, the sea bulged in the middle, and that's how. And the iron, the bronze casting for this thing would have to be awful strong. But they could do that sort of thing. That doesn't make me wonder at all. One commentator I had said these baths were filled up by the Gibeonites because they were the drawers of water. Well, that's pretty creative. We go now to 1 Kings chapter 7, verses 27 through 39. Then he, that Solomon, made 10 bronze water carts. The NIV and the NASB say stands, bronze stands. It's a stand, but it was designed to carry a basin of water, so that's why the Holman Christian Study Bible translates it as water carts. Each water cart was 6 feet long, 6 feet wide, and 4.5 feet high. This was the design of the carts. They had frames. The frames were between the cross pieces. Now, the frames here, the translations here are all over the place, but the Holman Christian Study Bible translation for frames, I think, is better as panels. One translation had panels. The frames were between the cross pieces, and the cross pieces of the framework of this cart. The cart had wheels on it, and so you had four legs sticking down at each corner of the square, and those four legs were attached to two axles upon which, at the ends of which were wheels, and so those four legs coming down were then connected with a square framework. So that's the framework it's talking about, the cross pieces it's talking about. Verse 29, and on the frames, that's the panels here, the panels between the cross pieces, the panels will run from one corner of the square to the other corner of the square. On those panels were lions, oxen, and cherubim. Always cherubim in the temple. They are a symbol of keeping people out of the Holy of Holies. Lions, a symbol of strength. Oxen, a symbol of strength. On the cross pieces, there was a pedestal above. So there was a flat bottom on those four pieces of wood that ran from corner to corner of the square. That was a flat piece of flooring, if you will, under the basin, making a pedestal. Below the lions and oxen were the wreaths of hanging work. Now I'm looking at a picture here. That translation is iffy there. It could be above or below or just below. But if you look at the panels on the four sides of the square, the panels that have the oxen and the cherubim and the ox and the lions, there's leaves at the top of those oxen and lion and cherubim, and there are leaves on the bottom of those oxen, lions, and cherubim, making a sort of decorative border around the living creatures. Each cart had four bronze wheels with bronze axles. Beneath the four corners of the basin were cast supports, each next to a wreath. The four supports of the square pedestal were next to a wreath. That means they came out from the bottom. Of course, the wreath of leaves were at the bottom of the panels under the living creatures. So the cast supports came out from below the leaves, verse 31, and the water cart's opening inside the crown on top was 18 inches wide. The opening was round, made as a pedestal 27 inches wide. So 18 inches is the diameter of the basin. The pedestal was 27 inches wide, so the basin is inside the square pedestal. On it, on the panel, were carvings, but their frames and the panels were square, not round. In other words, the basin was round, but on the outside, the panels were square, of course. There were four wheels under the frames, and the wheel axles were part of the water cart. Each wheel was 27 inches tall. That's a foot and a half. Well, that's what? No, that's 2 feet, 3 inches. That's pretty tall for a wheel. That's a 2 foot wheel. The wheel's design was similar to that of chariot wheels. Their axles, rims, spokes, and hubs were all of cast metal. Four supports were at the four corners of each water cart. Each support was one piece with the water cart. Those are just the four posts coming down from the square pedestal. At the top of the cart was a band 9 inches high encircling it. Also at the top of the cart, its braces and its frames were one piece with it. That's the panel. 9-inch high panel is going around the square box. He engraved cherubims, lions, and palm trees. I said cherubim, lions, and oxens. Oxen. So I was looking at the picture, I see an oxen, but here it says cherubim, lions, and palm trees on the plates of its braces and on its frames. In other words, on the panel work. Wherever each had space with encircling wreaths. In this way, he made the 10 water carts using the same casting dimensions and shape for all of them. Then he made 10 bronze basins, each basin holding 220 gallons, and each was 6 feet wide, one basin for each of the 10 water carts. So these are the 10 basins that the sacrificial animals were going to be washed in. Verse 39, he set 5 water carts on the right side of the temple, that's on the northern side, 5 on the left side, that's on the southern side, right against the courtyard wall. He put the reservoir near the right, the reservoir is the sea, near the right side of the temple toward the southeast. Well, the right side of the temple, where the southeast side of the temple is said here to be the right side of the temple, which is not usually, if you face the temple, the right side would be considered the northern side, but here it's the right side of the temple toward the southeast, so this would have to be facing the east. The right side is toward the southeast. He calls it a reservoir here, but in verse 27, he called it, or not verse 27, verse 23, he called it the sea of cast metal, or the reservoir. And that's the NIV translation. That's supposed to make it easy, and it's not. All right, I stumbled a little bit over the oxen that's on the panels, actually in verse 29. In the New American Bible translation, we have this: on the panels between the frames, there were lions, oxen, and cherubim. So we got lions, oxen, cherubim, and palm trees. Palm trees symbolizes life. Cherubim protects the Holy of Holies. Lions and oxen are strength. Now it says, on the frames, likewise, above and below the lions and oxen, there were wreaths in relief. Those two rows of leaves that I told you about earlier, depending on the translation. One translation just sounds like it's below, and one is above and below. Above and below makes more sense to me. Now these wheels, according to Gill, are said by most commentators meant to push the water around so you can move it around. Gill disagrees. He said they're just to hold the water, not to move the basins around. And I can think, why would you want to move them around? I don't see what the point of moving the basins around are. Now, this 220 gallons, according to the Holman Christian Study Bible, it's about a ton of weight. That's a whole lot of water. And then when you add all the bronze that the cart and the basin are made out of, that's about 2 tons of weight getting up there. We go down to 1 Kings 7, verses 40 through 47. Now, Hiram made the basins and the shovels and the bowls. Now, these basins are not the 10 basins that we just talked about, 5 on the north and 5 on the south, to wash the sacrifices. These are the buckets, the pails, of which were used to put ashes of the altar into. And the bronze altar in the front had to be cleansed of all of its ashes. They were dumped into pails. And the NIV translates them as basins here. The KJV has bowls. Well, the NIV has basins, shovels, and bowls. The basins to put ash in. The bowls here in the NIV translation would be the bowls that handle the blood of the sacrifices. So basins for ashes, bowls for blood. So Hiram finished doing all the work of which he performed for King Solomon in the house of the Lord. The two pillars and the two bowls of the capital. The two bowls, there's another word for bowl there. This is so complicated because of the translations. The two pillars and the two rounded projections, the two nodes of the capitals, those are the pillars. The round bulbs that had the bronze network around, wrapped around them, from which hung 7 bronze chains. So the two networks, that's the networks of bronze, checkerboard lattice work, to cover the rounded projections of the capitals which are on the top of the pillars, and the 400 pomegranates for the two networks, that's 200 for each pillar, 2 rows of pomegranate for each network, that's 100 in each row, to cover the 2 bowls of the capital which are on the tops of the pillars. Remember, those rows of pomegranates join the rounded projection, the capital, to the pillar itself at the bottom of the capital, and at the top of the capital, a row of pomegranates bound the capital to the lilies on the top. This is sort of a summary here. Verse 43, and the 10 stands with the 10 basins on the stands. We just talked about that for cleansing the sacrificial animals. Verse 44, and the 1 sea and the 12 oxen under the sea. That's for cleansing the priest. And the pails and the shovels and the bowls, the pails for the ashes, the shovels to shovel out the ashes, and the bowls to hold the drained blood to carry out the sacrifices. Even all these utensils which Hiram made for King Solomon in the house of the Lord were of polished bronze. In the plain of the Jordan the king cast them in the clay ground between Succoth and Zarethan. Now Succoth is a place we've encountered before in the Old Testament, and I'm going to talk about that in just a minute, but let me back up here to the fact that Hiram finished doing all this work, that's just sort of an incidental detail. But Adam Clark has an interesting comment about Hiram. Quote, "It is truly surprising that in so short a time one artist could design and execute works of such magnitude, taste, and variety, however numerous his assistants might be. The mere building of the house was a matter of little difficulty in comparison of these internal works." The temple itself, if you recall, took about 7 years to build. Now let's go to verse 46 and talk about where these bronze utensils and pieces of furniture were forged on the clay ground between Succoth and Zarethan. Well, now Succoth is sort of a famous place. Let me read you what Jameson Foster and Brown says about that. Succoth was situated on the eastern side of Jordan at the ford of the river near the mouth of the Jabbok, close to the Jordan. One reason assigned by commentators for the castings being made there is that at such a distance from Jerusalem, the city would not be annoyed by the smoke and noxious vapors necessarily occasioned by the process. But the true reason is to be found in the nature of the soil, the thickness of the ground. That part of the Jordan Valley abounds with marl. Clay and sand are the molding material still used for bronze. Such large quantities of metal as one of these castings would contain could not be fused in one furnace, but would require a series of furnaces, especially for such a casting as the Brazen Sea, the whole series of furnaces being filled with metal and fused at one time and all tapped together, and the metal let run into the mold. Thus a national foundry was erected in the plain of the Jordan. So Jameson Foss and Brown basically says it's the soil near the Jordan, near Succoth, that caused the foundry to be built there. Now Succoth itself has been mentioned before in our studies. We'll look at Easton's dictionary. Succoth is a city on the east of Jordan. They say it's on the east also. A high mound, a mass of debris in the plain north of Jabbok and about 1 mile from the Jabbok River. Here Jacob, on his return from Padan Aram from Syria, after his interview with Esau, built a house for himself and made booths for his cattle. The princes of this city churlishly refused to afford help to Gideon. Different story. Much later in the time of the judges, Gideon went there. They were faint, yet pursuing. They were chasing the fugitive Midianites after the big battle that happened up around Gideon's home stomping grounds in the valley of Jezreel. So Gideon followed one of the bands of the fugitive Midianites after the great victory at Gilboa. Gilboa is right there in the valley of Jezreel. After overtaking and routing this band at Kakor, Gideon, on his return, visited the rulers of the city with severe punishment. He took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. I love that King James translation. He taught them. It means he whipped their buns. At this place were erected the foundries for casting the metalwork for the temple. So three interesting places when Jacob came back from Syria with Rachel. Gideon went there and whipped the elders of Succoth, and there was a foundry there also. We go now to 1 Kings 7, verses 48 through 51, and we'll be finished with this difficult chapter. Solomon made all the furniture which was in the house of the Lord. Now when he says all the furniture, that's excepting the ark, the mercy seat, and the cherubim. The ark, because remember the ark had previously been brought from Kiriath-Jearim to Jerusalem by David. And Solomon just grabbed the ark and put it in the temple. But all the other stuff he made anew, most probably. He mentions the golden altar. That's the altar of incense, which was, of course, was made of cedar and covered with gold. The golden table, which was the bread of the presence. That's where the showbread was. And by the way, it's 10 tables. It says the golden table here. We know that from 2 Chronicles 4:8. He also made 10 tables, placed them in the temple. 2 Chronicles 4:19. Solomon also made all the equipment in God's temple. The tables on which to put the bread of the presence is plural. So how do you explain the singular here? Well, the commentators Benson and Poole say that one table is a synecdoche for 10 tables, a part standing for the whole. That seems like a strange synecdoche, but I'm not an English person, or a literary person, so. But we know there were 10 tables, even though there's only one mentioned here. Verse 49 also, the lampstands are mentioned, 5 on the right, 5 on the left, 5 on the north, 5 on the south. We've already mentioned that. In front of the inner sanctuary is the Holy of Holies. And these lampstands were made of pure gold. And the flowers in the lamps, those are the bulbs that were on the 7 branches of each 7 branch candlesticks. Remember, there was a lamp, kind of had a bowl with a wick in it, and then there was flowers around that bowl. So that's the flowers that belong to the lamps. And the lamps are placed on the lampstand. And the tongs of gold, those tongs which are used to deal with the lampstand, I'm sure is what that's referred to, and the cups and the snuffers and the bowls, all the utensils to deal with snuffing and trimming the wicks of the lamps, and the spoons and fire pans, that's for shoveling out the incense on the golden altar of incense, pure gold. The hinges both for the doors of the inner house is the Holy of Holies, the most holy place. Remember, there was two bifold doors, so there was hinges on the post and hinges in the middle of the bifolds. Four rows of hinges, and for the doors of the house, that of the nave, as the NIV puts it, that's the holy place. Those were made of gold. The hinges were made of gold. Thus all the work that King Solomon performed in the house of the Lord was finished, and Solomon brought in the things dedicated by his father David, the silver and the gold and the utensils, and he put them in the treasuries of the house of the Lord. Now he brought these things in, not to build the temple. The temple's already built. After he finished building the temple and furnishing it, then he took some gold that David had laid up for the temple and he put it in the treasury. He didn't use any of the materials that David had laid up. Remember, David was getting ready to build the temple. Nathan said, no, don't do that. Now, let me read you about this idea of dedicating stuff, David's gold and silver. Let's read what some commentators say about that. Gill says this: Solomon had brought in the things which David his father had dedicated, had laid up for, and devoted to the building of the temple, and for the service of it. Not all, but what was left, what was over and above, there was a need of. Though the Jews commonly say that he made use none of his father's, but built it and furnished it at his own expense, for which reason he did not begin to build as soon as he came to the throne, they suppose, the Jews suppose, but waited 4 years until he had laid up a sufficiency of his own to defray the expense of it. Gill goes on to say, but it is certain he made use of the brass, or the bronze, his father reserved for this work, referring to 1 Chronicles 18:8, which I won't read, and which perhaps it may be said is the reason it is not mentioned here as laid up. So you see, this issue of how much was laid up and not laid up is not quite as easy as I just said. Even the silver and the gold and the vessels did he put among the treasures of the house of the Lord. He did not convert them to his own use, but laid them up in the treasury of the sanctuary for the purpose of sacrifices, the repair of the house in future times. Okay, we can just say that basically he took David's gold and silver and wealth, stored them in a treasury for future use. Here's what Adam Clark says about this. It has been a question whether Solomon, in the structure of the temple, used any of the gold and silver which David had provided. And here it seems answered in the negative, for after the house was finished with all its utensils and ornaments, with its immense profusion of gold, it is here said that Solomon brought in the silver and the gold in the vessels which David his father had dedicated. It appears, therefore, that Solomon had employed 4 years to make preparation for the work before it was begun. During the whole time of the building, he was no doubt still appropriating a part of the public revenue for this purpose, and the provision made by his father he placed among the treasures of the house. But the temple was truly Solomon's, as he had provided all its materials and borne every expense. There seems to be a question of, did David help build this temple? He wasn't supposed to, and so if Solomon used David's materials, you could make a claim that David helped build the temple. To me, I think this is hair-splitting, but nonetheless, it seems to be an issue of sorts amongst some people. Here's what the pulpit commentator says, quote, so that all the store of precious metal and the brass, that's the bronze, that David had prepared was not absorbed in the decoration and furniture of the temple. There would seem to have been a considerable overplus, which was stored in the temple treasury. Ladies and gentlemen, with those learned comments, we are now finished with this difficult chapter, 1 Kings 7, and the palace has been built and furnished, as well as Solomon's temple in the first part of the chapter. We are now prepared to go to 1 Kings 8. We'll do the first 21 verses in our next audio. The ark is brought into the temple. It's already in Jerusalem, having been brought from Kiriath-Jearim by David, and now it's going to be brought and put into the temple. We'll do that in our next audio. I hope you stay tuned for that one, and I hope you enjoyed this one.